Hello, I'm Bill Martin, welcoming you to On the Banks. On the Banks is a fraternity podcast where we meet brothers, hear their stories, and celebrate the shared values of Phi Gamma Delta. Our guest for this segment is Bill Matz, a 1961 graduate of Gettysburg College. Bill has recently published his autobiography. It's titled My Toughest Battle, A Soldier's Lifelong Struggle with Polio. Bill began his military career in the U.S. Army shortly after graduating from Gettysburg and retired after 33 years of service in 1995 with the rank of Major General. That's a brief introduction to an inspiring story of persistence and lifelong accomplishment. It's brief because I want Bill to tell the rest of the story, and we have a lot of ground to cover, about half a century, I would say. So, Bill, thank you for joining us to talk about your eventful life.
Yeah, well, Bill, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to the fraternity's podcast. Very much look forward to it. So I wrote my book, My Toughest Battle, and it was recently released in January. Yes. Through Casemate Publishers. And it's really a story, as much as it is an autobiography of my entire life, it's really a story about overcoming adversity. I had polio as a young child, was stricken with it before the age of six, and I was living in outside of Philadelphia. And that at that time in 1944, the polio epidemic there was probably one of the worst that America had experienced. And just real quickly, Bill, and for the listeners, I know there's so many people today, they've grown up not knowing about polio, and that's a good thing. But polio was once one of the most feared and dreaded diseases in the United States, and it primarily struck young children. Therefore, they also called it infantile paralysis. But real quickly, in 1944, my mother was taking me over to my grandmother's in Philadelphia to visit. Again, I was only 5 1/2 years old. This was in, 1944. My father was in the Navy. He was gone. And I tried to walk across the living room floor and I fell. I tried to get up. I fell again. I tried to get up, fell again. My leg was paralyzing at the time. They called an ambulance, took me into the hospital. They spinal tapped me, and I was diagnosed with poliomyelitis, which is polio, infantile paralysis. And I was paralyzed from the hip to the toe. The doctor later told my mother in a later visit that I would never be able to walk again without the help of a crutch or a brace all my life. So it was a devastating blow to her. You know, she had no support from her husband who was gone. It was just me, and I had a younger sister. It was a tough time for us, Bill. But I was put in and out of a number of hospitals before they finally settled on the Home of the Merciful Savior, which is a hospital in Philadelphia. It's still there. And they dedicated that hospital to polio kids. It was so bad at the time. I was put into the paralyzing wing. And there I was very fortunate to get the Sister Kenny treatment in my treatment of polio. Polio is a virus, and it enters the body through the mouth. In my case, the germ got in there and it affected my right leg. It paralyzed the anterior horn cells that go down your leg. These are the cells that spark the muscle and build your muscle in your limb. So it killed all of them, and therefore there was no muscle. So my leg was paralyzed. They had to put me in a brace. But the Sister Kenny treatment was given to me after I was in the hospital for just a few weeks. Real quickly, Sister Kenny is an Australian nurse that they brought to the United States to assist with treating polio patients. She had an unorthodox way of treating patients. The American doctors believed in bracing the limb, stabilizing it, embracing it, and not moving it at all. We all know Franklin Delano Roosevelt had two legs paralyzed all of his adult life, was in braces all his life. So she advocated taking me out of the braces and using the moist hot pack treatments and therapy to try and reinnervate and reinvigorate the muscles in my leg. So that's how I was treated. And I was in a polio protocol until 1953, when I was finally released from outpatient treatment in the hospital. My leg was starting to rebuild, yet because of the initial paralysis, it shortened my leg forever, so I always had a limp. It also shortened my foot. I have a size 12 on my left foot, size 9 on my right foot. Had that all my life and had to cope with that. But anyway, that's the story, Bill, real quickly, of polio and how it hit me and what that disease was like.
Well, that's a good introduction, Bill, because as you say, very few people today are familiar with polio and with the impact that it had on families and the U.S. population up until well into the 1960s. But the thing that struck me about your book, your military and your post-military experiences in and of themselves make for a very interesting story, but it's that context of your battle with polio. That's really what takes the story from interesting to what I believe is inspirational. So I was struck by the fact that you seemed determined once you were through with the therapies in 1953, you would have been around 14 or 15 years old, perhaps, at that time.
Yes.
And you played sports in high school and didn't let it hold you back. Let's look into your military career now. Move into that. Early in your career, you went through paratrooper training and the rigors of Ranger School. My understanding, you didn't have to go through those necessarily.
No, that's correct.
Those were choices that you made. You spent much of your overall career in infantry and airborne units. For someone in the military who's had polio, you could hardly have chosen a more difficult path and career in the military, it seems to me. What were some of the physical challenges of that path, and why did you choose it?
I think, Bill, because I had polio, that really started when I was 6 or 7 years old, when I was actually an inpatient. They would have little contests for the kids that had paralysis on the leg. They'd line you up and see how far you could walk without a brace before you fell. They let you fall. They marked the floor and said, Matt's went this far, Smith went that far. So as a young kid, I looked forward. As I look back, I was only 6, 7 years old, I looked forward to those races and that competition. And I did not want to be a cripple all my life. And I did not want anybody to beat me. So I worked hard at those little contests that the hospital clinicians put on. And I think, Bill, as I look back on that, that gave me my grit and my determination as a young kid to overcome this crippling and this atrophied leg and want to be able to do what everybody else did. So, yeah, a long story short, I got through high school. I was able to play some sports in high school and in college. And my coaches were excellent mentors to me and helped me through my condition of polio and encouraged me all the time. My dad was a real instrumental to me. When he got out of the Navy and came home, we were upstairs putting the bed together one time. And I remember him saying, Bill, take that crutch and that brace and throw it under the bed. I don't want to see it again. I don't want you to be a cripple, nor do you. Of course, my mother, she went ballistic. She said, the doctor said, oh, he needs to wear that. He needs it. But he was right. And I did that. And that was a seminal moment in my life, Bill. My father, had he not done that, I would have continued to rely on that crutch and brace. But I threw it under there. And I cite that because it's a very key moment. So, yeah, when I graduated from college and I was able through in college to go to ROTC, And of course, in college, one of the best things I ever did was join the fraternity of Phi Gamma Delta. I'm purple throughout. I've got a purple shirt on right now. You can see that. But I learned that teamwork and that cohesion in the fraternity of Phi Gamma Delta, and that carried with me the rest of my life. So I was commissioned the same day we graduated in 1961. And I, again, wanting to keep up with everybody else, I volunteered for the Airborne. And I went to Fort Benning for my infantry officer basic. And then I was selected to go to the Airborne. I went to the Airborne training. At that time, you had to take, you were given a PT test to get into Airborne. You had to do a 2-mile run. You had to do so many push-ups. And then you had to do 80 deep knee benders in 2 minutes. So as the sergeant was counting them off, I got to 2 minutes and I only could get to 79. But you know what? He passed me. And he said, "Lieutenant, you owe me one." But think about that, Bill. That's another point in my life. He could have just as easily failed me. My whole life would have been different. But get to your point. Yeah, I went through airborne training. I was in the 82nd. I also was able to go through Ranger training, 9.5 weeks of Ranger training, which was the toughest training I ever did in my life. And I cite that in the book. And I went through with an all West Point class, and I didn't want any of them to beat me. I had that grit, that perseverance, that drive that I just wanted to be able, knowing I had a weak leg, I wanted to be able to keep up and show everybody I could do it. So I did get through that training. And as you say, why did I select the infantry? I thought, you know, if you're going to be a soldier, you really want to be a soldier. And that's down being a grunt with the infantry on the ground. So I selected that as a branch and went through 33 years of infantry in the Army, which really took its toll on my leg. It took its toll, as the doctor told me later in life.
So speaking of being a grunt on the ground, your first combat experience was as a rifle company commander in Vietnam in 1967 to 68, a service period that included the Tet Offensive that's sort of iconic in the story of the Vietnam War. And in the Vietnam War, as I understand it, the rifle company commander was one of the enemy's prime targets. As you were out on patrol, going through the jungles and the heavy vegetation and so forth that was common there in Vietnam, you were almost sitting ducks, and the rifle company commander was a prime target for the enemy out there ahead of you undercover. But you said that in that role, you never feared for your safety. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, that's true, Bill. Let me just back up what you said. The rifle company commander or platoon leader out there on the ground, and the infantry is the tip of the spear. The infantry is the branch of the Army that closes with and finally defeats the enemy one way or the other. So, the enemy was always looking, obviously, to be able to kill a company commander. The question on fear, as a rifle company commander, I was responsible for 160 soldiers. And we were doing search and destroy operations in the Mekong Delta, south of Saigon in 67, 68, which incidentally, Bill, were the two toughest years of fighting during the Vietnam War. We took most of our casualties those times. So I saw considerable action, considerable fighting, but I never had time. I never had time to think about my own self. I mean, at that time I was a young company commander, 27 or 28 years old, had 160 men I was responsible for. Plus I had the mission. The mission was to find and defeat the VC, the Viet Cong, who were operating in the Delta. And you just have so many things to think about and worry about that you just put yourself aside. It never occurred to me to worry about myself. I was always worrying about my men. Mm-hmm. And I would say the biggest fear I ever had during that year in Vietnam, particularly as a company commander, was the fear of losing an American soldier. That just bothered me more than anything. And that's where my thoughts and my fear were, more about losing my men than ever thinking about myself.
Understood. Yeah, I was impressed. Another thing that impressed me in the book was that in the infantry, the officers, up to and including generals, regularly participate in physical training. So even in your early 50s as a brigadier general, you were going on unit runs 4 or 5 days a week with soldiers who were 30 years younger than you. How did you manage that?
Yeah, that's correct, Bill. I mean, as an infantryman, infantry units, they have physical training every day, Monday through Friday. And it usually starts out with some kind of a unit run, whether it's a platoon or a company or a battalion run. And I always would go down and pick a different unit to run with. The soldiers, they loved the general to come down and run with them. And of course, what they wanted to do was run harder just to show you how great they were and to push you to your nth degree. So I had some tough times, Bill. But I will tell you this, as I said in my book, I never fell out of a unit run. I couldn't do that. Just think, you would lose face with those PFCs, those young sergeants, and you couldn't do that as an infantry officer. And again, as you say, I chose the infantry. I knew the hardship I'd be up against. I could have taken an easier branch where you're not out running every day, but I didn't do that. But it was very tough on my leg, very tough. And there were times, I'll be honest, I had an aide-de-camp as a general officer, and I would tell him, say, go up there and get a hold of that the sergeant or that company commander who's leading a run. Just tell him to slow down a little bit. The old man's getting tired here. So in a way, I sort of could control some of those runs. But I never fell out. And yeah, you had to do it. And yes, Bill, I'm paying that price right now, according to my post-polio doctor. All those hardship runs on my leg, you know, what was not easy.
Yes. Wow. But it definitely an inspiring part of your story.
Yeah. And I think I talk about that, as you say, pretty much in the book.
Yeah. You also write about the end of the Cold War in 1991 that prompted many changes in the military to focus on new challenges. What were some of the changes that you, as a major general at that time, were involved in planning and implementing?
Yeah, well, that's interesting, Bill. I've had a couple of people who've done professional reviews of my book, et cetera, and they said, you know, Bill, this is an autobiography, but this is also a walk through history. As you say, it's a walk through the Cold War, Bill, from the 60s through the 90s. And I just happened to be on active duty at that time and sort of with units that were very much involved in some of the Cold War incidents that we went through. So to answer your question, though, as the Cold War, as we were coming to a close of the Cold War in the late 80s, early 90s, yeah, the Army was reconfiguring. And we had moved from the Vietnam era. We had moved from the mindset of the heavy mechanized and heavy armored units that were stationed in Germany. The mindset then, we were all worried about the Soviets again attacking in Germany. But as the Cold War dribbled down, the Army had to realize that that was no longer the major threat. We had threats in our own Western Hemisphere. So we had to revamp our forces. We had to reorganize. I was very much involved with the planning and the organization of the new light infantry divisions that came into effect, I'd say in the early and mid 80s, and then assigned to the 7th Infantry Division. So I was very much involved in the planning of that and in bringing some of the new equipment into the Army's inventory.
Interesting, very interesting. In the preface of your book, you say, and this has come out so far in our conversation, you said that you've been a witness, if not a participant, in some of America's defining moments throughout the last 60 years. I would even extend that, if you'd allow me, those defining moments in that period to 80 years, going back to your experience with polio in your youth, because that was a really defining moment.
Yes.
That existence of polio and polio as an epidemic, as you called it, as you rightly called it, early on in our conversation. So really your book, the entirety of it and the entirety of your life covers a very interesting time in the 20th century and into the 21st century. But as for your military career, I'd like to summarize those defining moments because we can't cover all of them here in this conversation, but the defining moments that you witnessed or participated in and that you describe in your book. The civil rights movement, when you were deployed very early in your career during the integration of the University of Mississippi, there was very much of a strong military presence there to help support that process. The Cuban Missile Crisis, serving in Vietnam as a rifle company commander, serving on the front line of the Cold War in Korea, the invasion of Panama to depose a dictator, which was in the 1980s, as I recall, the first Iraq war in the early 1990s, and then, of course, the end of the Cold War, as you mentioned. And I cover this just to reemphasize what you said and what somebody else that, who had read your book said. There is a lot of U.S. history in your autobiography, a good part, maybe three-fourths of the 20th century. Is covered in some measure of detail in your autobiography. So it makes for quite a read and quite a life as well.
Yes, yes. No, and Bill, each of those major events, you captured them pretty well, beginning with the integration at the University of Mississippi, when James Meredith tried to enter the school and the white students would not allow him. There was rioting on. People were killed, cars and buildings were destroyed. They called the 82nd Airborne Division to go down. I'm a young lieutenant there. So that was an interesting time. And then a couple of weeks after that, Khrushchev tested our new young president, President Kennedy, with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was involved in the planning of that. In fact, remember till today what drop zone we were going to jump into had we actually executed the attack. But as you know, the quarantine worked. Khrushchev pulled the missiles out and Kennedy won. And then also very much involved in the in going down and getting Noriega. So with the 7th Infantry Division there. So we kicked out seven or eight infantry battalions. That was Christmas of 1989. Very much involved there and had a front row seat on that one and went down. I would tell you the American forces did an outstanding job on that operation. It was one of the best planned and best executed that I ever witnessed as an Army officer. We took the PDF out quickly. We only lost 23 soldiers killed in action during the entire operation. Of course, losing one soldier is a heartbreak, but that was a very small number compared to what we did there. And of course, we got Noriega out of there, who was an extremely cruel thug. So I went through all that, and that was quite an experience. The other thing, Bill, let me just pick up on real quickly. I had an assignment in there in 87 and 88 during the Reagan administration, where I was the executive secretary to our Secretary of Defense. And I'm sure some of the listeners here or people who will listen to this podcast, they remember Caspar Weinberger and Secretary Carlucci, two wonderful men. This was during the Reagan years. We were rebuilding after those terrible Carter years where he let the American Armed Forces sort of deplete itself. He also gave away the Panama Canal and other things. So I was in the Pentagon working with those folks as their executive secretary. That was quite an experience for me. But all of this was during the Cold War and moving up to the point in time where I retired and got out of the Army.
Yes, and after your military retirement in 1995. Over a number of years, you worked for at least for about 17 years in four different jobs post-military. Two of them were for for-profit operations. One of them was a nonprofit that provided services to service members and support to service members. And then one with a government agency. And I've got questions about two of those situations. First, in 2003, so I guess this was about 2 years after 9/11, while you were working in Saudi Arabia for a U.S. defense contractor, your compound where you and your employees were living suffered a surprise attack by Al-Qaeda. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and Bill, that was one of the, and I cite this in my book, there's a whole chapter on this. That was one of my toughest moments. Yeah, I was the program general manager for Northrop Grumman's large contract in Saudi Arabia. We lived in Riyadh. We had a Western compound right there. I had 1,500 men on my contract. And yeah, it was on the 12th of May, 2003, when the Al-Qaeda attacked our compound about 11:30 at night. And they ran a Dodge truck filled with munitions, busted through the gate, killed a couple of my guards, and ran it down through the compound right into the building where most of my men were sleeping. And they killed 10 of my men that night. I was not even there on the compound myself that night. I was about 70 clicks away in the desert doing a test for the Saudi National Guard brigades. And I got the call from my chief of staff. It was horrifying. We had no weapons. We couldn't fight back. I wasn't there. I felt so responsible. And it took me 3 hours to get across the desert that night in a Humvee to get to the compound. And my wife was there with obviously some of the other women. They were very lucky to have survived it. As I say, we ended up with 10 killed and 90, Bill, 90 in the hospital. They folks had lost limbs, lost eyes, etc. So I spent the next few weeks visiting them, taking care of them, and so forth. Very, very tough, very, very tough time for me.
Yes, yes. One other question regarding post-military career. In late 2017, you were about 6 years retired, had not worked or been employed for about 6 years in a deserved retirement. You were appointed Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission. You were 79 at the time. What was it about that job that lured you out of retirement?
Well, I know, Bill. People used to kid me, my family and my closest friends, that, hey, Bill Mance, when are you going to retire? Well, I thought I was retired at this point in time. So it's, what is it? It was 19, when Trump was elected for the first administration, that November, I got a telephone call from a couple of officers who were on his transition team. And I was sitting at home reading the newspaper. They said, Bill, how would you like to work for the Trump administration? So it's funny, the phone was on automatic. My wife was sitting there in the room. She could hear the conversation. She said, yeah, of course he would. He'd love to. She wanted me out of her space, Bill. You know how that goes, being a mayor. So anyway, one thing came to the one. They offered me jobs in the Defense Department or in the Veterans Affairs. I really didn't want that, but we settled on the American Battle Monuments Commission. So I was vetted for that, and Trump selected me out of a handful of people to be the Secretary of the American Battle Monuments Commission. And I was that for about 3.5 years during Trump's first administration. Bill, that was such an honor to be selected for that job. The American Battle Monuments Commission, for our listeners here, it's America's premier commemorative organization. It oversees and is responsible for all of the American cemeteries overseas and all the battle monuments. We have 26 cemeteries, 32 battle monuments in 17 countries on 5 continents. So you know I was out visiting, a lot of travel to that. But what you do is you honor and you take care of those final resting places and those beautiful commemorative sites of American soldiers who fell in battle. So I was very honored to have that. And it was quite a job. During that job, I happened to be there during the 75th anniversary of the D-Day landings. which was a huge anniversary ceremony we put on overseas at the D-Day beaches, the Omaha beaches. And also, I was in that job during the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I. Both times, I was the host for President Trump as he came over and spoke at those ceremonies. So a terrific job for a former infantryman. And I didn't see it as a job, Bill. I saw it as a duty. A former soldier taking care of soldiers, American soldiers of other wars, was a wonderful experience for me and an honor.
A sacred trust, as it might
yes.
be.
As
it
yes.
might be described. Yes.
Yeah. That's wonderful. A good way to describe it.
Wonderful. Well, let's talk about Phi Gamma Delta a little bit more. I think brothers who read your book will be impressed with how you describe your undergraduate experience at the Xi chapter at Gettysburg. And your ongoing relationships. You mentioned many brothers, many of your contemporaries in the Xi chapter in your book that you saw over the course of your career. What are one or two special memories of your time as an undergraduate at the Xi chapter?
Well, I'll tell you, the best thing that happened to me, I think, at Gettysburg College, obviously other than getting a very good education at the time, was receiving a bid to join the fraternity of Phi Gamma Delta, Bill, the fraternity that you led for a long time, and that I'm still a brother of. And some of my best memories there are just when we went down and pledged that day in September 1957. Back then, you were able to pledge your first year. And going through pledge training with those folks, there were 16 of us that pledged at Phi Gam there. And going through pledge training with them, going through then the subsequent 3 or 4 years at the college, and then, Bill, staying in touch with them all these years. My closest friends to this day are my 4, 5, or 6 fraternity brothers from my year group at Xi Chapter that are still living. And they've all, of course, bought my book. And prior to speaking to you, why the DC chapter of Phi Gamma Delta had me there to speak. And I was able to talk to a lot of the young brothers there at George Washington. They're in the process of forming a chartered chapter. Many of them purchased the book and had a lot of good questions. So I feel good about that. I just feel good about it. I look back on my day and look at these young kids today who are Phi Gams that are coming up. And some of them have written back after they've written the book. They've emailed me or called me and told me they got something out of the book. And that makes you feel good. It makes you feel worthwhile.
Sure, absolutely. One of the things that caught my eye in reading, describing your experience in the chapter was you were the, I think, social service chairman was the-
Yes,
was
yes.
How the chapter titled it, and the chapter won, or came in second maybe in the Baker Cup.
Yes.
In the competition with all Phi Gamma Delta chapters in your service activities that you helped to organize chairing that. That seems like a particular point of pride for you.
It really is, but it was a particular point of pride for all of Xi Chapter that time. As you know, Bill, this is one of our national awards. And here's this little small liberal arts Gettysburg College. We got second place the year I was a senior there. I happened to be chairman of that committee, but all the brothers pitched in and we were really working to get that. And we got second place. It remains a source of pride for me and for our chapter.
And did a lot of good. That's the thing about the Baker Cup is it rewards chapters for doing good for others. So whether you get second place or honorable mention or first, you've done a lot of good in the effort, in the process. Anything more about Phi Gamma Delta? Any other thoughts about it, what it has meant to you and the ways you've stayed connected?
Bill, there is another thought there. So Phi Gam taught me the importance of teamwork. We worked as a team, those pledges. And I cite some things there in the book. You know, our pledge trainer was a guy named Howard Bodie. Incidentally, he's still living today because I talked to his daughter and Howard just a few weeks ago. He got the book. But he taught us the importance of teamwork, the importance of brotherhood, the importance of taking care of each other, having each other's back, which wasn't even a term in vogue at the time. And I carried all those traits with me. I know that had a great impact on me. It had to. In years later, then I got into the infantry, and essentially the Army's the same thing. It's so you have each other's back. There's teamwork. There's respect. You learn quickly, Bill, who you can trust and who you can't trust. These are essential things I think any man needs to know in life as he pursues whatever career. All those were in the foundation that Phi Gamma Delta gave me. In our small Zi chapter in Gettysburg College during the late 50s and early 60s.
Very good. Wonderful testimony. Well, Bill, it's about time to close, but we can't do that until we let brothers know how they can get a copy of your book, if they're motivated to do that after hearing some of the things we've discussed. How would a brother go about getting your book?
Yeah, well, one of the easiest ways and most inexpensive ways, and frankly, I don't even know what they're charging for the book. I have nothing to do with that, but is to go to Amazon, Bill. Brothers can go to Amazon and just order the book there, and they'll have it overnight. You just type in My Toughest Battle under Amazon. It'll come up, and it shows you real quickly how to order. So most of my friends who have my book and are calling me or emailing, that's how they get it. You can also buy it, Bill, directly from Casemate, who is the publisher. And you can buy it in the Barnes & Noble bookstore. You can go there and order it. It's really, as I say, it's a book about overcoming adversity, yet it's a walk through history, which you just led us through. So there's so much in there to digest, but I would love for our current Fijis to get a copy. I think they would all get something out of it.
I definitely agree. I definitely agree. Bill, I want to thank you for spending time with us today. It's been a privilege for me to help tell your story.
Well, Bill, let me take this opportunity to let me thank you for your years of leadership with our fraternity. You were headquartered there in Lexington. And I remember, you know, as coming up, there was always Bill Martin, you know, he was the boss. So thank you for your years of leadership. And I appreciate very much being able to tell my story on this podcast.
You're welcome. And it's been a privilege to spend some time with you today.
Thank you.
There are many other interesting stories in Fiji land. Please join us again for another episode of On the Banks, as we meet brothers and hear their stories. And until next time, I'm mighty proud to be a Fiji.